Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread the books we should have paid more attention to when we were 16. I'm John McCoy, and with me today is Dominique Garnett.
Well, I am originally from Chicago. I graduated University of Illinois at Chicago with a degree in English. I'm currently living in Denver, working at a pharmacy, but I hope to go to grad school and get my degree in teaching English as a second language to teach immigrants how to speak English in America.
Dominique and I met online on Facebook, and she made the mistake of admitting that she had at one point gotten an English degree, which made me reach out to her to be on the show. And I asked her what she would like to read. And she turned around and offered a play that I had known of, but I had never read. And so this is going to be a new experience for me. We're doing Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun. Dominique, do you want to talk a little bit about your history with this book? And I assume you read it in high school.
Oh, yes. I've read this twice, once in high school and once in college. I can't remember why I read it in college, but I did read it in high school for freshman lit. So, you know, I'm not going with your podcast. It's not sophomore lit. Sorry. But it was freshman, and we were basically talking about gentrification. One of the reasons why this book is really important to me and was really important in my school is because, like I said, I was born and raised in Chicago. I went to high school in Chicago. And this book is set in Chicago. And it's basically not only gives you a history of African-Americans, but also the history of my great city of Chicago.
Where in Chicago did you grow up?
I grew up on the South Side, basically where the Youngers live, and on the South Side of Chicago.
Well, I always was told that the South Side of Chicago is just everything south of the middle of Chicago.
It's rough, but it's also, you know, there's also some beautiful places, I tell people, you know.
Now, I grew up in the middle of Illinois, and people outside of the state of Illinois don't realize this, but Illinois is much like New York in that Chicago doesn't have much to do with the rest of Illinois. Chicago was always the place that we went to on field trips. We would go to the Field Museum and to see the Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. I was interested when I was reading this book that this was in some ways an autobiographical work for Lorraine Hansberry. Her family was one of the first families actually to integrate into, what was it, Woodlawn?
Washington Park subdivision, yep.
Right.
On the south side of Chicago.
I saw it listed as Washington Park, and then I saw somewhere else that Washington Park is a part of Woodlawn. I don't understand. I mean, I live in Boston. We have our own craziness here with West Roxbury and Jamaica Plain and all this stuff. And
a lot of Chicagoans will be disappointed in me, because if you want to talk neighborhoods, I will be bad at it. I know it's North Side, South Side, West Side.
Right. Now, as I mentioned, right, this is not a book I read in high school, and it's one of those things that when I look at it, I feel kind of like, huh, because my education growing up in the Midwest was very white and very male. And this is right, a very black and a very female play. Yeah. And it made me feel very guilty right away to read this play.
No, you know, and I think I told you this. I was like, when I was looking at the books that you had done on your podcast, the first books, when you told me to pick some books, all of mine were completely white. And then I was like, I felt ashamed of myself. And I was like, you know, I'm a black woman. I've got to represent and pull out A Raisin in the Sun. And hopefully he'll agree with that. So I'm glad you did. But yeah, I was lucky that I went to high school. They were big on multicultural lit. No matter what race your teacher was, they would make you read all types of stuff.
Okay, well, let's give a little bit of background here. Lorraine Hansberry had a very short but an incredibly kick-ass life. She was born in 1930 to a real estate broker father and a school teacher mother. And as we mentioned, in 38, her father bought a house in Washington Park subdivision, which up to that point had been completely middle-class white. And they actually had to go to court over this because the residents did not like the Hansberrys moving in. So there's actually a Supreme Court decision, Hansberry versus Lee,
I
that
know.
her childhood was spent with the family being visited by some of the major luminaries of the Harlem Renaissance. Apparently, W.E.B. Du Bois was a friend of the family's, and the brother, William Leo Hansberry, was the founder of the African Civilization section at the History Department of Howard University. So she comes from a family of troublemakers.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I'm so glad that I'm doing this now that because I've never looked up her history. So I was like, wow, I should have done this a long time ago because this gives you just so much real insight into this book.
When I look at all the stuff that she did in a tragically short life, it makes me feel very insecure about myself.
Yeah, it's like very daunting, but just even her childhood is what I was just mostly interested in because I thinking about this play, I'm like, oh, she grew up poor, a poor young Negro girl, obviously. And reading about her, she was in the upper middle class. She was considered rich, and she was this rich girl, and she didn't like that. She wanted to be seen as a poor girl, so she would wear keys around her neck so people would think that she was a latchkey type child. And I'm like, that's crazy, but I can understand where she's coming from. She saw something in the poor life of the black community that I guess she wanted to imitate, and she does so beautifully in The Raisin in the Sun.
She is a fascinating character. She came along at exactly the right time. She was coming along at the tail end of the Harlem Renaissance, and she came into her young adulthood during the civil rights era. So she was right there, and she moved to New York City and worked on what was the newspaper,
Freedom,
Freedom,
I believe.
with
Yes. Yeah.
Du Bois. And so she was just kind of positioned at a time when everything was changing. And you want to talk about intersectionality, she was not just African American, but she was fighting for her space as a woman. There is apparently the open secret that she may have also been lesbian. She apparently contributed to alternative newspapers and publications. She was also highly educated, as she was able to take advantage of this middle class upbringing, but utterly dedicated to the cause of civil rights, not just here but abroad. She was very interested in Pan-Africanism.
I think you know more about her than I do,
I knew nothing about her about 2 weeks ago, and when someone told me, "Hey, read this play."
Well, you did a much better job because I've been so focused on the play. And I literally, I'm not going to lie to you, I just started reading about her yesterday. And I was like, I probably should have done this a long time ago. I'm so focused on everything that goes on with the play. It's like knowing the author is a big part of that. And I completely forgot. So I apologize,
Well,
listeners.
we'll wrap up with this background information. She had in college studied drama, and Raisin of the Sun was her first play. And unfortunately, she only lived long enough to write two plays. It was a huge success on Broadway. It had a hard time getting backers as the first Broadway play to have an all-black cast, but it ran for something like 500 performances or something like that, and then it was adapted into a movie, and it was first produced in 59 and adapted into a movie in 61. And the other thing that I, when you look at this play, is the original production had just this monster cast. It had Sidney Poitier, it had Ruby Dee, it had Louis Gossett Jr. and Claudia McNeil. It's like all these major, major African American actors, and I kind of wonder, as I look back on this now, how much this play was central to their careers, and to what extent their being in that cast was what buoyed this play up. I mean, probably both.
That is one thing I did look more into, is just the production of the Broadway play. And I can't really speak on the stars. I mean, Sidney Poitier is a big star, and that definitely, I think you're right, that definitely bolstered it. But I was just reading into, like, how much they had to cut out of the play. And I remember being, like, really nervous with you, wondering if you had the same, you know, version as I have, because they cut out several scenes out of the movie and the Broadway play, apparently, because of time. And they were like, we can't have this be a long play and have African-American people in it. No one's going to buy this. No one's going to finance it and bring it to stage. So in order to make it a little bit more, you know, more ready for stage, they cut out a lot of things. One of the scenes they did cut out was a scene where Benita unveils her natural Afro-textured hair. And I've seen two versions of this play, movies, 2008 and 1961. And in both those movies, that scene was not in there. So it's like this steady ongoing thing where they cut it out at first and then they're still cutting it out, because that's just how people remember the play, without certain things in it.
Mm-hmm. Now, we'll cover that when we get to that, because mm-hmm. that's a kind of an interesting... I think that's an interesting scene, given that I think there's recently been a lot more public press given to the issue of the politics of black hair. Mm-hmm. And I was, as a white boy, I want to stay out of this, and I want to let you have.
No, I apologize. I kind of went ahead.
No, I want, but I want to hear more about you, about your thoughts on that matter. But let's But the one thing I did want to say that is really just sad but funny. If you see the trailer for the 1961 film, they obviously are just so terrified of marketing a movie with a black cast, because it just, the trailer starts out not with any of the scenes of the characters. It starts out with the producer David Susskind talking about this wonderful play that won the New York Theater Critics Award. The trailer is 2.5 minutes long, and it takes them 1 minute to get to Sidney Poitier's name on the screen. And it gets 1 minute and 15 seconds until you actually see any of the actors in the film. It's quite remarkable for the way that it dances around the fact that this is a play about black characters.
Right. Wow.
Anyway, let's get into the play here.
Okay. So we begin at Act 1, Scene 1. And we start off with a description of the Younger's home, which one of the sentences that stands out to me is, its furnishings are typical and undistinguished, and their primary feature now is that they have clearly had to accommodate the living of too many people for too many years, and they are tired. So we have this well-lived-in, depressing home. The first character we're introduced to is Ruth Younger, who is the wife and the daughter-in-law, the wife of Walter Younger and the daughter-in-law of Mama. So basically, she's just trying to rouse her husband and her son. Her son lives or sleeps in the living room, which serves as his bedroom, trying to rouse them out from sleep. I'm not really good at summers.
That's okay. You know what? One thing I would say that I thought that was kind of funny to me when I started reading this is, there's an old adage when you're taught to write that you should avoid the cliche of starting your story with somebody waking up. and this play starts with Travis asleep on the couch, waking up and going to the bathroom, and right. I just kind of thought that was kind of funny, because it's such a powerful play, but it also, there are these little kind of quirks about it that mark it as kind of an outsider play, in that I think that it does disobey some of the rules of drama. But it, on the other hand, it adheres very strongly to one rule, which is the entire action of this play takes place inside that one apartment building.
Yes,
and
right.
It's so claustrophobic, and so, and you got, that set has to be well designed if you're going to have actors running around that set all for the entire play, because that's all the audience is going to see.
It's just one large room. And one of the things that, no, I'm sorry, I'm going to the movies, but one of the things that took me out of them is that they took them out of that room like several times. And I was like, wait, what's happening? Stop it. But yeah, so I do want to say one thing about the description of Ruth that I glossed over. The disappointment has already begun to hang on her face. Even though it's beautiful, she already has disappointment hanging on her face. And so you get right at the start, this is what this play is going to be. It's going to be about disappointments and, you know, a family living rough. And yeah, so she tries to get Walter and Travis up. And yes, yeah, so there's another funny, there's a funny part about this opening scene, is this whole thing with the bathroom. Apparently the entire building, or the entire floor, shares this one bathroom. And so the beginning is so frantic and rushed because you have several characters rushing out of here trying to get to a bathroom that's shared between them and many other families. It's like one of my favorite parts of the story.
This opening scene, I think, does a great job of setting both the somberness of the play, but also the good humor and the irony and the ways that the people in the play are able to navigate this rough space. Because there's humor here once Walter gets up and he and Ruth spar about him getting off to work on time, and he's full of his complaints about the world and his lot in life and his dreams for something better. And Ruth is very practically telling him to eat his eggs. And so that, yes, it's a kind of a back and forth that shows a marriage under stress, but it also shows two people who kind of know each other pretty well.
Yeah, the eggs is a big thing too. Eat your eggs. Just eat your eggs. You know, everything he says, she comes back, eat your eggs.
Right,
eat your eggs.
Right.
Lord, no, you can't make love to no colored woman first thing in the morning. Eat your eggs. Just this, you know, this first scene is probably the happiest, or one of the happiest moments in the scene, but it still has this tense undercurrent of, you know, a man who's just really tired, and a woman who's just really tired of him too.
Right.
You know, going back and forth, the colored man and the colored woman fighting who has it worse, who's responsible for the other one's pain, but still with this hint of humor where you can still kind of smile at it.
Now, Walter struck me very much, especially after I saw Poitier's depiction, as just this guy full of nervous energy. You know, we'll get to in a moment, you know, things have changed here in the family in a very fundamental way, and it's gotten him innervated about the future in a way that he hasn't been. The question I have, you know, is, do you see Walter as our protagonist, or do you see Mama, Lena, as the protagonist of this play?
I think as a kid, because I was so angry about what Walter did, and we'll get to that. I think as a younger person, I would definitely see him as the antagonist, and not antagonist, you know, I think that's Mr. Lender, but I would see Mama as the protagonist and not Walter. But now that I'm reading it in adult's eyes, I do think he is the protagonist. I mean, you know, Walter is not an easy person to love, but I think now I root for him now. And I want him to be okay. I want him to be the man that he thinks that he knows that he's supposed to be, and, you know, rule the world like he wants to, or, at least get a better job. You know? I want good things to happen for Walter. So I do see him as a protagonist. You know, I do root for him.
The other person who pops up here now is the sister, Benita, I can't help but see Beneatha as sort of a stand-in for Lorraine Hansberry herself. Do you get that feeling too?
No, yeah. I give her Beneatha as well as Asagai.
Right.
Asagai, yes, both of them.
Yeah, I mean, because Beneatha is... She's a young woman who wants to go to college. She wants to become a doctor. She wants to change the world. And she sees the way to change the world as getting an education and getting ahead and becoming cultured in life. And for her, culture means reconnecting with an African tradition.
Yeah, Beneatha is a stand-in. But, you know, I usually have a problem with stand-in characters. They seem too fake. But in Beneatha's case, she doesn't seem fake to me. She seems a little fake in the way that you can hear Lorraine coming out of her. But at the same time, I know this person, you know. I know this person. I kind of used to be this person. So she still speaks to me, you know. And this, you know, this wanting to be better, wanting to do better. And, you know, wanting to just get out and you know, be the best that she can be. That's something that really goes to my soul. I mean, everyone in this is the main theme is everyone's got dreams, and hers to everyone else seems like the craziest one. A black woman doctor? What are you talking about? I love a character like that who knows what she wants, and I don't give a damn if I am a black woman in the 1950s. I'm going to be a doctor. So I think she's my favorite character, honestly.
She's a very funny character, you know, in many ways. And I have to admire Hansberry, because when you look at Hansberry's own beliefs outside of the play, they do seem so in line with Beneatha. Hansberry was also an atheist. Hansberry was also hugely interested in the effects of colonialism in Africa, and believed that that uplift to black people would come not simply by civil rights at home, but also by throwing off colonialism in Africa. But she wrote a character like Beneatha who is so silly and who has so many foibles that are just out there for all to see.
Yeah, and I totally get her foibles, her shortcomings. And I actually dug deeper into that in preparation for this, because I realized, as somebody who's grown up more and has become, you know, a little bit more of a feminist, that, you know, she isn't all she's cracked up to be. You know, she, you know, we'll get into that later, but I do still love her. And I do also think she's silly, but she represents something that it was just insane to say these things in 1959 as a black woman. So I love her.
They've been talking obliquely about a check arriving in the mail, and it turns out that the family is awaiting a life insurance policy payment for the father, Walter Sr., who has just died, and the family is to come into $10,000. And everybody has ideas about what to do with the money. Walter Jr., he's got his eyes on a liquor, is it a bar or is it a liquor store?
It's a liquor store. No, you're right, it's a liquor store.
A liquor store. And he wants to go in with some other guys and buy a business, because he sees the way forward for the family is to become entrepreneurs, and he sees this as a huge opportunity. And he also feels, to be honest, kind of entitled to the money as the man of the house.
Right, yeah. And that's my problem with him.
And, of course, Beneatha has designs insofar as she wants to continue to go to get an education, although she sort of denies that she really wants to use this money herself. But, of course, all the money for this family can't help but be sort of communal. And the interesting thing is that Ruth, Walter's wife, who was fighting about the eggs, she kind of poo-poos Walter's aspirations in the scene. But when Walter has left for the day to go to work, she talks to Lena, the matriarch here, who is going to get the money, and she supports Walter's dreams, actually.
She sees something's happening between her and Walter. And this is something that's been happening since before the play. We were introduced to these people that he's just slowly deteriorating. And this, and she thinks this money will help him out of his funk, will help him to be the man of the home like he thinks he's supposed to be. And yeah, she just talks to mama about that.
Right. I mean, she thinks that she's worried that he's drifting away from the family because he's spending more and more time out of the house. She's worried that he's lost interest in her, that he's lost interest in being a father to Travis. Certainly, both she and Mama suspect that he might be seeing another woman, which the play doesn't support, but that's where their minds go. It's a family that's kind of in crisis because it's just kind of slipping apart. And Mama has a different plan altogether. She thinks that they could take some of the money and put a down payment on an actual house, and they would no longer have to rent, and they could, and while it's still kind of unclear how they're going to afford to make mortgage, at least they'll be out of this neighborhood.
And that's a, and that, I'm
No,
sorry,
go ahead, go. No, say.
and that's a dream I think that the audience can really more relate to. So, which is why somebody would see Mama as the protagonist. I mean, I know myself, if I lived in a cramped apartment, which I kind of do now, it's $1,000, which in now's money is $82,000. I mean, I'm not thinking about a liquor store, I'm thinking about a house, and so. Yeah, I think, I think a lot of the audience is like, I think Mama's got the right idea, but you can't tell Walter that because Walter's looking at a plan so that he can be in charge of something and be like a man and something that can keep generating money. He's not thinking about being comfortable. He wants to be rich. He wants to be like the white boys, as he said, he sees out and doing their business deals.
Right.
That's his dream. But Mama's just thinking small. I just want a house. And I think a lot of more people would identify with that, especially the white people who would be seeing this, now they're already pretty rich. They're thinking, oh, well, Mama's got the right idea. Get a house.
Just as this play chronicles the movement of African Americans into these residential neighborhoods of Chicago, it's also around this time that the whole American dream is being codified in a larger sense, because before World War II, home ownership wasn't really something that most people aspired to. This was something that came in part after World War II and the GI Bill, and so there was a lot of that going around. A lot of people wanted to get in on home ownership, and so this becomes, of course, contested territory because other people who don't want to live in desegregated communities see it as a property issue. In any
No,
case,
they'll throw out that old adage, the property values are gonna go down.
right,
And that's
exactly.
why we don't want you guys here. It's like, no, you're racist.
The check does arrive in scene two, and there's a everyone's passing around the check and just kind of amazed at the number of zeros on it. We are introduced to a new character. Another We've been told that Benita has been seeing this guy named George Murchison. We haven't seen him on stage, but now we see another suitor for her attentions, Joseph Asagai.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know
That's
what?
like a
And he's from Nigeria. And this is one of those scenes that I thought was that I feel, again, as a white observer, I have to be very careful about what I say, because I thought it was incredibly ballsy of Hansberry to have this scene about African Americans discussing Africa and having no clue as to what they were talking about.
Yeah. I really like this scene because Mama especially, Benita's telling her, when he gets here, Joseph Asaiga, when he gets here, don't ask him any ignorant questions about Africa. And she's just like, who, me? How would I ask any ignorant questions? And she basically goes on like, black people in America don't really know anything about the country where their ancestors came from, except for crazy stuff like Tarzan and missionary work, and that there's a lot of poor people there. And so Mom was like, well, she's just like so innocent. Well, I give them money so they won't be heathens and all this stuff. And just like Benita, who's just this intellectual, she knows everything. Well, I'm afraid they need more salvation from the British and the French, basically alluding to the fact that the British and the French are, occupy a lot of the countries in Africa, due to colonialism. And it's just this back and forth. It's between, just two different generations. One generation of, look, I give money to, church so they'll feed the Africans. Another generation of, there's more than that. There's more than just that to Africa. There's a lot of things going on, and I'm, intellectual and smart, and I'm going to tell you all about them. So then Joseph comes and he talks to Benita. Does he talk to Mama first?
Well, he brings in the he brings the dress.
The dress.
Right.
This is, yeah, this is the one where I get this confused with this other scene, but yeah, this is the one where he brings her the dress. And it's a typical African robe dress, and he had it sent all the way from Africa for her. And then he ruins the moment, basically for me at least, by talking about her mutilated hair. And this is what I was talking about earlier. So what he means by that basically is that she has straightened her hair, like most African American women back then did. They didn't. They we didn't. We had to have it straight, like to look proper. And even now, that's a lot of black people think that if your hair isn't straight, you don't look proper, you don't look sophisticated, or you don't look professional. I get that a lot as somebody who does not wear hair straight. But yeah, she's like she finds offense in this, and he basically brings in this theme of assimilation. And assimilation, why is it so popular with African Americans? Why do you want guys want so badly to be just like white people? So there's this kind of this conflict, and you could probably see it even out today between Africans and African Americans, who's more proud of themselves and where they came from. One of those, and that discussion on her hair basically just shows that theme of assimilation and what Asaga's talking about.
Asaga comes from Nigeria, which at this point is not yet independent. It's still under British rule until 1960. And Nigeria, for all of us out here who don't know enough African history, which was me until, like I said, a couple of weeks ago, is just this enormous country. And it's this enormously complicated country, but it's also the country that in Africa that has the largest economy and has some of the newest and most urbane centers. And one of the things that's funny about the back and forth between Asagai and Benita is Asagai is accusing Benita of assimilationism, of wanting to take on sort of middle class values, of wanting to become sort of bourgeois. And on the other hand, Benita has this romance of Pan-Africanism where it doesn't matter to her whether she's talking about Nigeria. At another point, she talks about Kenya. At another point, she mentions the Nile, which is, of course, in Egypt and Ethiopia. And she's just kind of all over the place. And to her, she has this beautiful fantasy of what it means to be African. I do think that this is again one of the wonderful strengths of this play is in a very small group of people, we have all these different ideas of what it means to be true to yourself racially.
Right. and, you know, true to your dream as well.
Right.
You know, whatever you aspire to, right?
Lena and Walter discuss the plan to get a liquor store. Lena does not want her money to go towards selling people alcohol. And there's a scene here that you wanted to go over that's kind of a central scene of the play between Walter and Mama.
Yes. Well, basically, it starts with Walter telling Mama just what he feels about, you know, his life and his job. And I'll just read a little bit.
Sure.
Walter, Mama, I'm looking at you. You're a good looking boy. You got a job, a nice wife, a fine boy. And Walter goes, a job? Mama, a job? I open and close car doors all day long. I drive a man around in his limousine and I say, yes, sir. No, sir. Very good, sir. Shall I take the drive, sir? Mama, that ain't no kind of job. That ain't nothing at all. Mama, I don't know if I can make you understand. And so it goes on like that. And he has this beautiful speech. God, I love it so much. About seeing the future just in front of him, hanging over at the edge of his days. And it's just this big space of nothing. You know, I see these people, these white boys, sitting down and talking about things and making money and doing all these things, and they don't look that much older than me. So God, this just gets to me so much, because he basically feels like a failure. He feels like less than a man. He feels like nothing. And he sees in this money a chance to make something out of himself, to be the man of the house, just like he knows he should be. And there's another thing of, you know, just this generational conflict. It follows with him saying that money is life. And Mama's just, you know, flabbergasted by her, because she comes from a generation with African Americans where no one cared about money. It was about freedom, you know, trying not to get lynched in the South. So the fact that she came all the way from the South, where, you know, the racism is just way worse there, to the North, you know, with her husband, made a family, lives in a decent neighborhood and had a home of their own. That was all that she thought that a black person could ever want, freedom. But there's just this disconnect between generations, with Walter going, no, that used to be how it is. Because he's freer than his mother's generation before him, he sees that there's more freedom to be had, you know, financially and socially. So just escaping the South isn't enough for Walter. He needs something more.
It's a beautiful scene, because, as you say, I just keep thinking about the generational aspect of it. It's hard to overstate the truth of what Mama is saying here. If she was coming up during the Great Migration of the 20s, that was a time of African Americans fleeing just immense persecution under Jim Crow, and
right,
the ever-present threat to life that represented at that time. And to have him say money is life seemed like a slap in the face. But on the other hand, as you say, we can all understand Walter's desire for something more. You know, this is the thing about dreaming and being true. The play keeps asking this question of sort of like, what would represent a way forward for people of color in America? Is it for people to have the freedom to make individual choices and to pursue individual adventure? Or is it more about protecting your family? Is it more about protecting the sense of the race as a whole? And everybody keeps going back and forth over these issues.
Yeah, everyone has their own version of what black people, or, you know, themselves and black people as well, should be reaching for, should be struggling and striving for. And yeah. Walter and Mamas does not match.
Later, we get to Act Two, and there's a very silly scene where Benita wears her Nigerian dress and plays a record of Nigerian music and starts dancing around the room. And it's unclear whether or not she really knows what she's doing or whether she's making this up as she goes along. But she's very scolding to the family about them not joining her celebrating their African heritage. And Walter comes in after having been on a bender, and he has his own reaction to the music.
No, that's I love the whole book. I keep saying I like this thing. But that was so funny because you know that if Walter was sober, he'd be looking at her like she was a crazy person, just like Ruth is. But Walter's got some liquor in him, which makes him a little bit more, you know, confident in himself. So they're just going back saying, "Akoma gosie," and I just read, like, listened to it in the 61 version, "Akoma gosie, Akoma gosie," and they're doing an African folk dance, and Walter's doing it with Benita, and Benita's shouting at him, and he's shouting at her, "Flaming spear, hot damn!" And basically, Walter is just in his own little world where he's the leader of this tribe, and he's got his shirt open, and he's leaping from table to table with his spear, and he's a man now, and it's just like this kind of like this dream sequence of a scene, I mean, where he's like, he's in his own world, and in the lighting, like Lauren Hansberry writes, and now the lighting shifts subtly to suggest the world of Walter's imagination, and the mood shifts from pure comedy. It is the inner Walter speaking. The Southside chauffeur has assumed an unexpected majesty. And it's, do you hear the beating of the wings of the birds flying over the mountains in the low places of our land? Akoma gosie! It's just like, and you're just there with them. It's like a crazy scene, but it's like kind of serious for Walter. He's doing what he, you know, he thinks he should be doing. He's being a man, you know. He's right. Back with his tribe.
Benita's other quarter, George Murchison, arrives, who, this is the first time he's actually been on stage. And he can't figure out what's going on here. He makes some snide remarks. One of the things that's interesting about George to me is Benita scolds him about not having more pride in his African heritage. But George seems to know from his dialogue, he seems to know an awful lot about Africa. Maybe he's picked some up from Benita, but he's got his country straight, at least. Which is right. More than Walter does, but George has no interest in this. He's interested in being a successful American, and for him that means taking on sort of middle class values, and he sees that as a legitimate way forward, you know, both for him and for other Black people. As you mentioned before, they cut out these scenes that have to do with Benita's hair, and this is the other part of that, is that she reveals her hair, and he just wants nothing to do with it.
It's so funny. It's kind of how my mom looked at me when I cut off my hair and had it unstraightened. Like, what are you thinking? And I do not like George, and I don't think you're supposed to like George. And it's so funny because you said it exactly. He knows so much about his African heritage, but he doesn't give a crap. It's like, let's face it, baby, your heritage is nothing but a bunch of raggedy-ass spirituals and some grass huts. It's like, you're so educated about, you know, African culture, but you're so dismissive of it. He's dismissive of what she's wearing. He's dismissive of her hair. And that's another running theme in the book, I guess we'll get into a little bit more, is these men who are part of Benita's life who are controlling her. Right. And he's the worst of all, you know. He tells her, you need to go change. And she does it immediately, but, you know, not without a fight. Just like Benita is, you know, screaming at him about all the advances Africans made and how great they are. And he's just not having it. And you get a sense right away, you're not supposed to like this character at all.
Oh, you know, we left out a very important part of the plot, I just remembered. Oh, okay. Which was in scene one. It ends with Ruth fainting, And in scene, in Act One, Two, we learn that Ruth is pregnant, that it's an unplanned pregnancy, and it comes out that she has probably been seeing a basement abortion provider. She hasn't yet gotten an abortion, but Mama is very upset about this, partly because it also turns out that she and Walter Sr. Lost a baby. She talks about that at one point, about the how it tore at Walter to lose a baby. And of course, for Lena, family is everything, and she can't understand the idea of someone aborting, because to her that just seems like a betrayal of the whole idea of family.
And one of the at the end of is it scene two, act one, where she implores with Walter, I don't care about this liquor store. You need to talk to your wife and tell her not to do this. And Walter's just, she tells him, I'm waiting for you to be your father's son, and he doesn't feel like his father's son because his father's son would be the man of the house. So, what she's saying to him is just not going through. He can't say anything, and he just walks out. And it's just such a it's a really heartbreaking scene. It's just she it's you feel like Mama has given up on him.
It's a hard scene because it's about his rejection, or his disinterest in her pregnancy does reflect that overall disinterest in the family. And of course, that's the big threat right now, is that
Right.
he's going to become so detached that he's going to leave his family behind. That emerges, I would say, as sort of the central conflict of the play. Mama shows up in this scene and announces that she actually has gone to the bank and put a down payment on the house, a house with some of the cash. Something like, what was it, $3,500 of the check. And Walter is very upset about this. He thinks that this means that he's not going to be able to buy the liquor store. Ruth is happy.
And how can you disagree with Ruth? That cramped old apartment, this woman is thinking about, giving up her child so that she could save the rest of her family. How could you not be excited with Ruth about having a space, having a home? No, it's just so sad, and she just begs Walter, you gotta let me be happy about this. And she's been beaten up. And Ruth is kind of the forgotten character in this play, but that woman has been through just as much as Walter. It's
Right.
just that Walter's, whole vision of manhood makes him seem like he's the most put out character. But Ruth,
It's interesting you say that about Ruth being sort of the forgotten character, because when I read the play, I kept kind of waiting for more to happen with Ruth. I thought that in some ways she kind of got short changed with her amount of dialogue or time on the stage. But when I saw the movie and I saw, Ruby Dee's performance, it's just there every minute of that woman is on stage being quiet. You can see the tiredness and the anxiousness in her eyes. In many ways, Ruth represents, I think, kind of the continuation of Mama's values, because Ruth, her allegiance is to family. Specifically, her allegiance is she wants to make Walter happy, but she wants that. But that's partly because she wants Walter to be present for the kids, and that's her main goal going forward. In just the same way that I think Mama's main goal is keeping the whole family together, whereas Walter and Benita, they're siblings, and they're very similar in that they both are putting a lot of stock in their own dreams, their personal dreams.
I made that connection too. It was
Yeah.
like, as much as they go back and forth, they're the same. They're all about what they want, what they think is most important. But like you said, Ruth and Mama just want to keep the family together. And I think that's Yeah, when you have two adults that are on one side and two that are on the other, but everyone's still fighting with everyone. It's just crazy. It's chaos.
Scene 2-2. We gotta keep this moving along, or we'll be here all night.
I know.
It opens with Benita and George returning from their night out, and George is putting the moves on Benita. It's all that kind of 1950s sort of
Yeah.
sexual tension that you're not quite sure whether you're supposed to be reading this, that George is going to try and sleep with her, or whether this is
Right.
just what's going on here. But it does emerge that George just basically wants Benita to toe the line, whether that means, giving in to his advances, or whether that means, putting down the Nigerian dress and straightening her hair and being a middle class woman. He just wants her to kind of conform and go along.
Yeah, he basically tells her that the only thing she needs to be interested in is keeping up her appearance so that men can be interested in her. And we know Benita by now. And we know that's not going with her. He says men aren't interested in women's thoughts. And this is where I don't think Asagai or George are that great for Benita, but this is where you really see that well, George really isn't. He's just so dismissive of her as a person, as a thinking person. And I understand the frustration. I understand sexual frustration, but the things that he says to her are so just wrong. And we know Benita, and we know that that's the end of that.
If you have the full edition of the play, as you mentioned before, we have a visit here from the neighbor, Mrs.
Oh,
Johnson.
yes. I'm
And
sorry. I love Miss Johnson. She's horrible.
and Mrs. Johnson did get cut from the original production, and she's not in the movie. Now she's a neighbor who comes in, and basically she's kind of a foil to everybody's dream. She tells them it's they're crazy to try and move. Why would they go anywhere where people don't want them? She brings up violence that other African American families have had to deal with when they moved into white neighborhoods, and she's just kind of a wet blanket over everything.
Well, you can't leave out the phoniness.
Right.
She's make when she first comes in, she makes it seem like she's excited for them. Oh, I'm telling you, the youngers are moving on up. This phony kind of like happiness for them, but then it slowly turns into you guys are crazy and oh my God, they don't want any black people out there. She still has this kind of upbeat personality. I think that's how she describes her, constantly upbeat.
Mrs. Johnson is kind of played as a comedic in this scene too, to kind of bring in some jokes. But she is also, I think, to my mind, she borders a little bit on stereotype, in that she's kind of a stereotype of that nosy neighbor, who meddling neighbor, and she just kind of exists to play devil's advocate to Lena's dreams. I can see why she would get cut. Maybe a good actor could bring some more out in this. I don't know. You seem to like her more than I do.
I do like it because I feel like every African American person who's ever tried to really do something and try to make something of themselves and do something out of the norm that's supposed to be out of the norm, quote unquote, for African Americans know this person. They know they have a Miss Johnson who's oh, she just thinks she's so uppity going to college and thinks she can't talk to anybody. We know this person. So for me, I love the scene, but I understand why it got cut. And one of my favorite parts of it is her bringing up Booker T. Washington,
Right.
who that part where she says, "An educated—I forgot the exact quote, and I can't seem to find it—but an educated mind, basically, an educated mind has ruined a good plow hand." Basically saying, I mean, this is what Booker T. Washington actually said, basically that African Americans should worry at that time, at least, shouldn't worry too much about education. They need to be learning skills for manual labor. And she says that to Lena as if, that's gonna, change her mind. And Lena's like, he's a fool. Lena doesn't care that that man is Booker T. Washington. He's one of the greatest African American heroes of all time. No, that man is a fool. And this is where she turns away from thinking that Walter is being foolish and starts to be on his side. Through the eyes of Mrs. Johnson, she's like, it's good that my kids want more, you know? And that's when she starts becoming on his side. Like, Walter wants more. That's good. I'm proud of him.
Right.
You know, in the face of just ignorant woman. So, yeah, I love the scene.
The one thing I also really admire about this scene and about the play in general is, as you say, she brings up Booker T. Washington. This is a play where people talk openly about the bigger picture of what's going on and the way that it intersects with their lives. And it always seems very natural and unforced. It's not like, it's the way people actually do talk about their situation. You know, it's the way that politics does intersect with private life. And I think that Hansberry was just great at writing that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Walter's boss calls them. You know, Walter has been working, as we mentioned before, as a chauffeur, and says that he hasn't shown up for work for 3 days. And Walter, when asked what he's been doing, says that he's just been out wandering and going to see jazz club musicians, and how excited he tries to get Mama excited about this combo that he saw.
It's like no one's trying to hear about your saxophone guy, Walter. Why haven't you been going to work?
Mama decides to give the rest of the money over to Walter with the stipulation that he deposit $3,000 of it into the bank so Benita can use that towards a college fund, and the remaining $3,500 will be for him to invest as he wants in his businesses. Walter is elated and excited, and he runs off to make a transaction, he says, that will make them all rich.
Yeah, and that's when it turns around for Walter.
Right.
He's a new man. You know, she's finally given in his, put in his hands the keys to being the man of the family.
Right.
You know, and, yep.
So in the next scene, which is 2-3, they're getting ready to move out of the house. One thing that we should mention here is that is that throughout the play, Lena keeps tending to a house plant that is kind of one of the central symbols of the play. This poor house plant that has been failing because of lack of light, but she loves it, and she wants to keep it alive. And so that symbol of kind of the cramped, lightless existence, symbolizes the family. I just bring it up because it's going to come up at the end of the play.
No, yeah, that's when my freshman symbolization, you know, lesson comes in.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty obvious symbol to be honest, but it's nice.
No, it is. Yeah.
Now, as the family is getting all excited, ready to move, the one white character in the play shows up, a guy named Carl, who represents the Clybourne Park Improvement Association from the neighborhood that they are moving into. And at first, Walter seems to think he's there to welcome them to the neighborhood. Benita, I think, right away can smell what's happening.
Yeah, she's not having it.
and basically, he's there to try and dissuade them from moving into the neighborhood. His argument, and it's Carl likes to think of himself as extremely reasonable and extremely polite and kind, and just trying to do what he thinks is in everyone's best interest, which is for everyone to just live where they live and not where other people live. And he says that the neighborhood association is willing to buy out their down payment and actually put a little extra money on it so that they make money on the deal. just so long as they don't move into their neighborhood.
This really polite type of transaction. He's like, we're not that type of people. We're going to be polite and we're going to sit down and talk to you like gentlemen and just ask that you not move into our neighborhood. it's like, come on, you're delusional. You are just as prejudiced as the people putting crosses.
Right.
On burning crosses on the southerner's door.
I mean, there's not much to Carl. He's kind of just a figurehead for a kind of
person.
Yeah. They tell him to go, and they're not going to at this point go in on this offer.
Yeah, well, before he does, he kind of gets a little threat in.
Yeah, yeah.
People can get awful worked up when they feel that their way of life and everything they've worked for is threatened.
Right.
Like, spooky, ominous.
Mama enters, and they tell her about Carl's visit, and she packs up her plant, and they give her a gift of gardening tools, which in the movie, if you watch the movie, this scene happens in a very odd little inset where they actually get out of the apartment and go and walk through the house that they're buying. And I consider it kind of an odd scene because the movie follows the play very closely, which means there's a lot of dialogue. And this scene in the movie, there's almost no dialogue at all while they're walking through the house. And they're playing sort of that happy 1950s background music where the family coming to the new home. And it seems like, it just doesn't seem like it is in the right film to me.
Right. No, yeah, I get that too. I got that too. I was like, is this a different movie? But it actually happened in the 2008 version. So I guess the 2008 version liked that scene and they decided to do it again. But it doesn't fit really in either one of the versions, and more so in the 61 version.
The family is all happy, and just at that moment, one of Walter's friends, who's been in on this business deal that he's been trying to arrange to buy the liquor store, this guy named Bobo shows up and announces that Willie, who was a mutual friend that was entrusted to take the money and actually go make this deal on the liquor store, has absconded not only with the $3,500, but also the $3,000 that Benita was supposed to have. And it's a kind of an abrupt resolution to this whole buying a liquor store thing in a way, because you kind of expect there to be more build up or something, or some more obvious. I guess you got the feeling, or at least I got the feeling, maybe because I knew this was a kind of a dark play as I was reading it, that there would be more explanation as to why Walter would have entrusted this guy with this money in the first place.
It completely just baffles you. Like, you give not only what was supposed to be your part, but your sister's part to this man and just trust him to go to Springfield. And I mean, it blows your mind. It's one of those things that can, if you're someone who's just like really, you know, like particular, it could take you out of the play. Like, there's no way in the world that man would be that stupid. But you think about Walter and all he's been through, the type of person he's in, you think, yeah, he can't be that stupid. he could do that. And he would think he's just so anxious to get that liquor store, to build his dream, to be the man of the house. And he made a horrible mistake trusting Willie Harris.
Mama is not happy. She actually strikes Walter, and Benita breaks them up, and the scene ends with Mama talking about the about what that money meant in as far as the sum total of her husband's life. You know, it's sort of all through this play, people have been seeing this as this opportunity. And the question is, who's going to get access to this money? And she's suddenly reminded that this is her husband. You know, this was his life, and this was the recompense for his life. And now we move to Act Three, which only has one scene. Asagai shows up, and he decides to propose to Beneatha.
I had a hard time getting into this scene. I don't know why. Maybe Asagai started boring me, but yeah, I'll say what I have to. Well, basically, he sees her, sees that she's basically giving up on her dream because of what her brother's done, and he does have one good point, and he reminds her that if her father had not died, she still would not have that money, and so he says there is something wrong with the house where all your dreams are depending on the death of a man. And I think that's a really powerful point that he makes before he proposes. And you know, they just have this back and forth about her still trying to reach her dreams and do what she has to do. And you know, Asagai talking about what he dreams to do and what he wants to do is go back home. And as an educated man teaching the people in his village, even under colonial rule, and he knows it's going to be hard, and he knows he might even get killed, but he wants to do that. And you know, if he can stand in that the face of that adversity, then she can stand up in the face of this adversity, and she can be better for it, you know. And he does make good points, but I don't know why I can't get into the scene completely.
Asagai is a nice guy and a noble guy. I don't have a strong sense of his personality, though. I guess he's really presented as a kind of an upstanding guy, and he does encourage Beneatha to continue to follow her dreams and to try and find some alternative ways to get educated, and he wants her to become a doctor so she can come back to Africa with him as a doctor. He's both a romantic in that he wants to be with her, but he also wants her to have her success in life. If George thinks that a woman's only good to look good, he wants her to be successful on her own terms, but he also wants her to come to Africa. And one of the things I kind of like about this play is it leaves it kind of an open question whether or not she's going to accept this offer or not. It's a kind of it leaves a lot of agency with Beneatha as this play ends. You know, she's still calling the shots, and she still gets to make the decision, and it can go either way depending on what the audience wants to think.
It's kind of one of the few times she has her own agency. You
Yeah.
know, she's been told by everybody else what she should do and what she shouldn't do. I mean, even in her own feminist, atheist ways, she only became so interested in her African roots, I mean, even before this play began, because of Asagai. And you know, it's you know, she finally says, this is the decision that I have to make, and but we don't know if she makes it or not, what she makes of it.
Mama and Walter announce that they've decided they're not going to move. Walter says he's called Carl, and they're going to have him come back so they can recoup this money and maybe a little bit more, and go ahead and sign his pay the papers saying they're not going to move into the home. Walter says that when Carl shows up, he's going to put on a whole show for him. He's going to act really subservient. You know, he's kind of bitterly going to take on the stereotype of the obsequious black man.
It's horrifying,
Yeah, it is. It's
basically.
the low point of the play, and but when Carl shows up, and Walter actually starts to deal with him, as he's talking to him, Walter also recalls his father, and he realizes that the legacy that his father left was not so much the money, but the pride that his father took in his life, and the
Especially coming off of the whole subservient speech that he gives, it's this light bulb. You just see it go off right there on the page. He's like, I can't, you see him just saying this, hey, I can't do this. He just goes on about what his family has done. And the funny part, the one funny part in the scene, my father almost beat a man to death once because this man called him a bad name or something. You know what I mean? And he's just like, okay. Mr. Lund is like, yeah. and you know, he just comes, and like Mama says, he becomes a man through this speech. He's like, we're a proud family. And my son here, he's going to be the sixth generation. And I'm not going to have my family lower itself just because I made a mistake. We're going to move into that house and we'll make it work. And, you know, one of the things he said is we're not going to fight. We're not going to make any trouble for nobody or fight no causes, or we will try to be good neighbors. But, you know, I mean, Linder doesn't care. He doesn't want them there, period. You know, and the rest of the neighborhood does not want them there. But yeah, he's not stooping that low. And it's a beautiful thing to see him really coming to his own.
The play does end with the family leaving the apartment with Mama picking up her beloved houseplant. And what I like about this play a lot is It ends on this kind of, you know, this kind of a mixed note. It's you know, it's hopeful in one sense because the family is going to move to a better place, you know, better conditions for the family. It's right. Unsure how they're going to be able to afford this place as they go on. It's left unsure, of course, what the neighbors are going to think. And sadly, the history of Chicago bears out the fact that when African Americans moved
in the play it's Clybourne, but yeah, with Lorraine Hansberry is Washington Park.
Right, they all emptied out. The white people all mm-hmm. emptied out, and yep. I mean, but it's a kind of a two steps forward, one step back sort of situation.
Right.
It's still better than than living in a rat trap apartment. If you look at the other big plays that are coming out at this time, and you'd think that like this is around the time that Arthur Miller is writing, like mm-hmm. all these big ponderous plays in the American theater at that time were just unrelentingly tragic. You know, somebody had to die at the end of one of those plays.
Right.
And this play doesn't kill anyone off other than the mama, you know, taking in a few licks at Walter for losing the money. There's no like familial abuse or family breaking mm-hmm. up. It's like
yep.
they're moving on. And I love that, you know, because so many plays want to go for the throat. They want to like, you know, go for the big Shakespearean tragedy and somebody's going to have to commit suicide or die violently or something.
No, it's funny that you say that. And one of the reasons why I did pick this, I wanted to pick something that had African American themes. It was written by an African American person. One of the reasons I picked A Raisin in the Sun is that I hope I don't get any flack for this. Is I've taken a lot of American literature courses, and so much of the literature is unrelentingly, you know, just depressing. And it's because it's about Black people growing up and being in a place that hates them, it doesn't want them. Some of these authors, just abuse, all types of abuse, lynchings, the suicide, just like you said. I mean, one book that I did think about was this book called Passing. And at the end of The Passing, a woman commits suicide. I was like, I don't want to deal with that on my first time on the podcast. So I'm going to pick something where it does end with just hope. It ends with hope. And it, yeah, we don't know what's going to happen. They could get a brick thrown through their window just like Lorraine Hansberry did. But Lorraine Hansberry didn't write that. So we're going to just think that everything worked out fine. And it's a nice little light in a lot of literature that is very dark.
I read the introduction to the play that was written by Lorraine Hansberry's husband. Robert Nemiroff was her husband, and they were together, and they divorced, but they still remain kind of business partners, and he was her literary executor. And the thing that I liked that he pointed out was that when this play came out, the producers went through a lot of trouble to market this to the wider play-going audience. which unfortunately, you know, let's be realistic, means rich white people. So a lot of critics at the time who wanted to champion the play talked about sort of universal themes of the play, about how it's universally about family and overcoming adversity and stuff. And he, I thought, very thoughtfully said, you know, let's not forget that this was a very specific production of a black woman at a very specific time of American history. And that's important to remember, because I think, especially, you know, as a white kid growing up, I could believe the lie that these things didn't matter, that everyone's lives were just like your own personal choices. I could live that kind of dream of just having no ethnicity, having no history, everything. And it does a disservice not to look at this play as a very particular production of a very particular time by an extraordinarily gifted woman.
Yeah, I read that too. And yeah, it's important to remember that this is, you know, it has universal themes, but this is about a black family in a black neighborhood dealing with black problems. And if you ignore that, then you're ignoring the racial aspects, and you're ignoring history. You're ignoring what you live in today. I mean, this is what has been going on and will go on forever. I mean, it gets a little better every year, but you know, it's always going to be true that somewhere in this world, African Americans will be looked at as less than, and we will try to overcome that and make our dreams come true and not have them be deferred.
So what do you feel is different for you about this play, reading it now than in high school?
Well, it's just this different feeling. One was the whole Walter as a protagonist thing. Two was that as an adult, I mean, as a child, you get kind of shielded from a lot of things. And now that I've seen institutionalized racism, you know, not uphand, Lord Jesus, like in the face, it stared me in the face. And, you know, I'm not protected from anymore. I'm a grown person. I can't really put it into words. It connects to me on a different level. I'll always love this play, but I think every time I read it, I'll love it a little bit more now that I'm as wiser that I get. I'll find something new to love about it. And now that, you know, I've become a little bit more of a feminist, or a lot bit more of a feminist. I hated that word when I was in high school because I was an idiot. I see beneath them a new light, and I see that all the things that she's going through. And as much as I, you know, kind of feel for Walter, I identify with her more because it's really hard to be a black woman. I just wanted to talk about A Dream Deferred by Langston Hughes. And I just wanted to say that it's my favorite poem in the whole wide world. And and it's the most fitting I think it's called an epigraph I've ever seen for any book or play. It's just about, this is exactly what it's about, what happens to a dream deferred, what happens to Walter's dream when it's deferred. Does it just dry up like raising the sun, or does it, you know, explode? And it kind of exploded, but at the same time, I think he did get his dream, so.
Thanks again to Dominique Garnett, both for discussing this play and suggesting it. If you have a work you'd like covered on Sophomore Lit, you can let me know by emailing me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. A Raisin in the Sun is copyright 1959 Lorraine Hansberry. Please see me if you haven't yet prepared your thesis statement for this semester's paper. And remember, everything will be on the final.